on this wonderful meeting. I want to discuss some, classical mobility problems for analytic functions and their corresponding analogs in the quasi-conformal, quasi-regular world, which I will define. So let's first understand review quickly some notions about the size of sets. So everything in this talk will take place in the complex plane. Assume E is compact, then a measure function, also called a gauge function, is, basically it's a positive at 0, at 0, non-decreasing, continuous on the right function, etc., so that you can define the corresponding Hausdorff measure of E. The usual function is a function of type t to the power s, and then the Hausdorff measure will be denoted by this calligraphic hs, but one can define other Hausdorff measures. And dimension, we always denote for us Hausdorff dimension of E. So a quasi-regular mapping is a mapping from between two open sets in the complex plane. It's orientation preserving. It's in W12 locally, meaning the function and its gradient are both in L2 locally. It's continuous, and the directional complex derivative satisfy this distortion inequality bounded by this constant capital K, which is bigger than one. This is part of the classical definition. Some pieces of this definition are redundant. For instance, continuity is redundant, and this exponent 2 it can be improved by a result of Wolberg and Peter Michel. But, let's stick to this. If on top of these conditions it's a homeomorphism, then we say F is K quasi-conformal. The topological orientation preserving, topologically orientation preserving. So this is recorded up here in the blackboard. So an important, the Jacobian is always bounded by the maximum length distortion squared. The nice thing about this quasi-conformal or quasi-regular mappings is that you also have the upper bound by K times the Jacobian. So this allows, essentially, if you know distortion for a K quasi-conformal mapping, if you know distortion of length, you're going to know things about distortion of area and vice versa. Equivalently, these mappings satisfy the so-called Beltrami equation, which is, the one on the board. D bar equals mu d, where mu is an L-infinity coefficient, an L-infinity measurable function, with L-infinity norm less than 1. Big K and little k are related by this, by this formula, so big K is always bigger than 1. Using Calderon-Sigmund theory, one can prove that the Beltrami equation can always be solved. Okay. So, those conditions are, as I said, recorded in the blackboard. Yeah. A few more basic, ideas about quasi-conformal mappings is that a K quasi-conformal mapping is locally 1 over K Helder. This is a theorem by Mori, and this suggests some of the ideas that will appear later. Geometrically, a conformal mapping will send infinitesimally a disk to a disk. It may dilate it, but it after all goes to a disk. Infinitesimally, a quasi-conformal mapping sends a disk to an ellipse. And then macroscopically, it sends a disk to a quasi-disk, which is some kind of Friedeck, so that you can fit inside a circle and outside another circle, and the ratio of the radii is bounded by a constant which only depends on K. So something long and thin like this is forbidden. Something like this is forbidden because these two guys almost touch each other. So, it should be something kind of round. Typical examples of quasi-conformal mappings are, of course, conformal mappings, Bielefschitz mappings, and the so-called radial stretchings, basically C to the K, but preserving the modulus. So you put C to the K minus 1 times C, or C to the 1 over K minus 1 times C, the modulus. No? And these two are K quasi-conformal, and this will appear later. No? An important theorem in this theory is the so-called Stoilov theorem, which basically says that if you have your Beltrami equation, there is a unique normalized homeomorphic solution, and then any other solution to the same equation is your unique normalized solution composed with a holomorphic mapping, and conversely. So all K quasi-regular mappings are your K quasi-conformal map composed with holomorphic mappings. This idea will appear later, but a preview of something of some of the ideas appearing later is that if we understand the distortion of the quasi-conformal part, and we know removability theorems for the analytic part, we will get removability theorems for the whole composition. This will become clearer later. A very important result in this context is the famous Astalas area distortion theorem, which basically gives SARP a condition for area distortion. No? So if E is a measurable set inside the disk, then the area of F of E divided by the area of F of B is bounded above by a constant, which only depends on K, times the ratio of the corresponding areas of the sets raised to the 1 over K, and this is SARP. This was very celebrated because, well, it basically, as I implied above, if you understand area, you understand length, you understand a lot of things. So one consequence of this area distortion is that the Jacobian of a quasi-conformal mapping is in LK over K minus 1 weak, and this is SARP. It's also another consequence is a dimension distortion estimate, which is also SARP, which is given by this formula here. So again, all dimensions are Hausdorff. So 1 over dimension of F of E minus 1 half is bounded above and below by constants K and 1 over K by the corresponding thing without the F. And this is SARP. And an improvement of this integrability of a quasi-conformal mapping is that if your quasi-conformal mapping happens to be conformal on a certain measurable set, meaning the D-bar derivative is 0, then the Jacobian is in strong LK over K minus 1, and this is again SARP. This is a result by Astal and Nessie in 2001, approximately. So, the notation that I want to use for the distortion of dimension, meaning the one appearing here, is basically this one. I want to focus on the stretching, so you increase the dimension. So you start with a set of dimension D, and then, depending on your dimension D and on K, you can get at most to a certain dimension D prime, which has a certain formula, which comes from here. So the an open conjecture in this field, a pretty important one, is that if you start from measure 0, you get to measure 0 in the image here, Hausdorff measure. A particularly important case, which we'll comment on later, is when D prime, the target, is 1, then you compute what the source is, and it's 2 over K plus 1. So an idea which, we will exploit later, is that, by Stoilov again, any K quasi-regular mapping is going to be K quasi-conformal, composed with a holomorphic mapping. So for instance, it's known by Penleve, and we will review that later, that any set of length 0 is removable for bounded analytic functions. By this picture, this theorem by Astala, with these concrete exponents, anything with dimension less than 2 over k plus 1 will go by a k quasi-conformal mapping to something of dimension less than 1. If it has dimension less than 1, it has length 0. So from here, you get length 0, hence it's removable for bounded holomorphic mappings. So anything of dimension less than 2 over k plus 1 is removable for bounded k quasi-regular maps. This is the simplest case of what we will exploit later, and it will become later much more complicated. So basically, the classical theorems there are a bunch of classical theorems for bounded analytic functions. We will substitute analytic for quasi-regular, and we will substitute also bounded for bounded BMO, Helder alpha, or Lipschitz, and they are following the corresponding analogs in the classical case. So let's review probably the most important case, or at least the one that required most work in the analytic case, the so-called analytic capacity. So for any compact set, you define analytic capacity. We don't care what the definition is, because what we care is the characterization. So the characterization is that something has analytic capacity 0 precisely when it's removable for bounded analytic functions. That is, any function which is bounded and analytic around, in an open set containing your compact set, can be extended analytically to the whole open set. This does not depend on the open set, and for instance, if the open set were the whole complex plane, then by Liouville's theorem, your function would be constant. So a crash course in analytic capacity is that dimension 1 is critical. So we saw already Penleve's theorem, length 0 implies analytic capacity 0. This is 1920s. As a consequence, of course, anything of dimension less than 1 has analytic capacity 0. Anything of dimension strictly bigger than 1 has analytic capacity positive. That's Alfors, 1947. If you are in dimension 1, things get more complicated. So let's assume you have finite length. We will talk about, if you have finite length or sigma finite by a theorem in geometric measure theory, Besicovitch and Federer essentially, your set can be decomposed into garbage, which means length 0, disjoint union with rectifiable. Rectifiable means contained up to a set of measure 0, of length 0, contained in countably many Lipschitz curves or C1 curves. Disjoint union with purely unrectifiable. Purely unrectifiable means any rectifiable curve will hit it in length 0. A classical example of a purely unrectifiable set, if you haven't seen it, is the Garnet 1/4 Cantor set. No? So you start with the square, and then you repeat, and so on. Okay. So after a huge amount of work, basically the bottom line is if you have finite length or even sigma finite length, your the piece responsible for positive analytic capacity is the rectifiable piece. This is essentially Garabedian and Calderon, and your analytic capacity is 0 precise if and only if you are purely unrectifiable. The final step for this in the finite and positive length is Guidavit, but there was a huge amount of work before by Nazarov, Trail, Wolberg, Michael Crist, Peter Jones, Leger. It's a huge industry here. Ferdera, Melnikov, Matila, well, a lot. So in the sigma finite case, this also holds by a theorem of Tolsa. And the full characterization for analytic capacity 0 was given by Tolsa, which is complicated. It depends on the, there are two characterizations, but it basically depends on the geometry of the domain. It's something called curvature, Menger curvature. So let's go back to the quasi-world. What we have there is, in analogy to the analytic capacity, we say that a set is L infinity K removable if it is removable for bounded K quasi-regular functions. So any K quasi-regular function, defined outside the set, can be extended quasi-regularly in the whole complex plane. If K equals 1, we get analytic. So by Stoilov, recall your K quasi-regular map is K quasi-conformal composed with analytic. Since our sets here will be typically small, like dimension 2 over K, 2 over K plus 1, your set E has 0 areas, so the Beltrami coefficient is defined almost everywhere, so this piece extends. The only problem is where the analytic piece extends. So your set will be L infinity K removable precisely when your analytic capacity of this G is 0, of the image by a K quasi-conformal map. So you take your set, you hit it with any K quasi-conformal map, and you have to prove that the corresponding analytic capacity of the resulting set is 0. So dimension 2 over K plus 1 is critical for this case. We already saw that if your dimension is less than 2 over K plus 1, you're removable. This we saw a few slides ago. For any dimension bigger than 2 over K plus 1, by the sharpness of the dimension distortion, you can find a quasi-conformal map, a set, Cantor-type set, and a quasi-conformal map, which will map you to something of dimension strictly bigger than 1, and then by Alfors theorem, your analytic capacity is positive. So it's critical. So the question was, what's the borderline? What happens in 2 over K plus 1? The conjecture by Ivanik and Martin in a paper in ACTA in 1993 was that if your measure, Hausdorff measure, was 0, then you would be removable. That's indeed the case. This is a paper which will appear in Duke Maturnal. It's a joint paper with Astala Klopp, Mateo Orovitz, and myself. So it's a series of theorems. Let me present sort of the bottom line of them. So if you start with measure 0 at the critical dimension, any K quasi-conformal mapping will map you to length 0. Then immediately by Penleves theorem, you're removable. We also get a weaker statement for the target dimension between 1 and 2, because we were also looking for this conjecture of Astala that you start from measure 0, you get to measure 0. We didn't get that except for this case when the target is 1. To be fair, the removability that is obtained through this argument was obtained through a slightly different argument previously by Astala, independently in a preprint. So the ideas of this theorem is basically Riemann's theorem that the BMO invariance of the invariance of BMO, under quasi-conformal changes of variables, Astalanes' result on the improved integrability of Jacobians, Hellder inequality, and understanding BMO capacities. What is more surprising is that if you are sigma finite, well, you're in the critical dimension, your image is also sigma finite, well, that is a similar proof to this one, but then you are also removable. This is completely false if k is equal to 1. So, for instance, a line segment. So the ideas involved in the proof of this theorem of the removability in the sigma finite case basically is that, well, you need to prove that the image of your set is purely unrectifiable. So you want to understand the distortion of a rectifiable set by the inverse mapping, which is also k quasi-conformal. No? So in order to do that, I mean, the trickery we use is Alford's factorization of a k quasi-conformal mapping into 1 plus epsilon k quasi, into 1 plus epsilon quasi-conformal maps, conformal welding, which basically means that you decompose, I mean, you can assume your set is contained in the boundary of the disk. This is your 1 plus epsilon quasi-conformal mapping, so this is the first step in the decomposition when you look at the inverse. And then you decompose your map into basically 3 maps, so that this guy is conformal from the outside of the disk to the outside of this domain, and 1 plus epsilon squared quasi-conformal globally. This guy satisfies the same thing, but the conformality is from the inside to the inside. And this guy, the same thing, but conformal, say, from the inside to the inside. So from here to here, we use Makarov's estimate or theorem on the dimension of harmonic measure. From here to here, we use the control basically by integral means, which is controlled by Brennan's conjecture. It's a certain conjecture on the growth of integral means of conformal maps. So the conjecture is not known, but it's, I mean, the conjecture is a certain exponent, p squared over 4. But it's known that, it satisfies a certain bound like 9p squared, whatever bound this is. So this is enough for our purposes. And from here to here, we again use Makarov's compression theorem. So then, I want to put that one there. We also get, so this is for sufficient results for removability. We also quite somewhat surprisingly get that there is, if you go above the dimension, the critical dimension 2 over k plus 1, because the distortion of rectifiable sets is smaller than what you would expect, and that was somehow one of the underlying ideas in the philosophy of the theorem I just drew over here, then you can find, if the distortion is small enough, you can find sets which are removable of dimension strictly bigger than the critical dimension. But there are also sets of dimension equal to the critical dimension which are not removable. So basically the picture is the following, for at least for L infinity. In the analytic capacity case, k equals 1, everything is removable up to length 0. In dimension 1, it depends on the geometry. Above dimension 1, it's non-removable. This is the classical case. If you put k removability, k is strictly bigger than 1, then up to dimension 2 over k plus 1, sigma finite, you are removable. So again, sigma finite is, I mean, different from the classical case. At dimension 2 over k plus 1, you can find sets which are not removable. Then there is a region where some things are removable, some things are not. And then from some point onwards, things are not removable. This point, we don't know where it is. It's believed to be less than 1, but we don't know that. So now we can, well, I mean, I'm actually working on, I mean, with Tulsa on finding a sharper condition for removability here. No? Now, instead of the L infinity case, you can think of the BMO case. So the classical theorem in the analytic case is essentially Kaufman and Kral, which basically says that you're removable for BMO mappings, I mean, BMO analytic mappings, precisely when your length is 0. So now, if you try to understand the corresponding analog in the quasi-world, by a theorem that I stated before, if you recall, if you start from length, I mean from measure 0 at 2 over k plus 1, then you get length 0. So then you are k-removable. So this means, as a corollary of this paper of the 5 authors that I stated before, well, if you are 0 at dimension or measure, or at dimension 2 over k plus 1, then you're removable. Also, by this theorem that is up here, theorem 5, the non-removable example for L infinity k, k quasi regular maps in dimension 2 over k plus 1, there is a not sigma finite but BMO k removable set at dimension 2 over k plus 1. So there was an open question left in this paper that I mentioned before, basically as to whether the BMO and L infinity removability problems could be distinguished. This amounts to finding a map, a set and a map, so that the set is positive and finite in dimension 2 over k plus 1, not BMO k removable, that is, under a k quasi conformal mapping, it would reach to a set of positive and finite length. All the previous examples did not give that. So the answer is yes, this is just a paper of my own, this exists, and it's very technical. So I will draw a picture of the whole thing in a moment. Now you can look at what's the Helder condition. So the Helder case, the Helder removability for Helder analytic mappings was essentially done by Dolchenko. So, I say Helder, I mean locally Helder. Helder for points at distance less than one. And they are removable precisely when the Hausdorff measure at dimension 1 plus alpha is exactly 0. This is for Helder alpha. Okay? So now you want to understand the quasi version of this. So a theorem by Klopp says that there is a critical dimension, namely this one, so that if you have measure 0 at this dimension, you are removable for alpha Helder k quasi-regular maps. And for any dimension bigger than strictly bigger than this critical one, there are non-removable sets, but there is a gap in between. What happens if your measure is positive and finite? The idea for theorem B, which will appear later, is that, you build a counter-type set, then the map has whatever Helder exponent you want, or you expect, sorry. This is, because you are starting from dimension t and you get to dimension t prime, whatever maximum stretching you get. And then you take the Frostmann measure, you take the Cauchy transform of the Frostmann measure, and you compose this k quasi-conformal mapping with the Cauchy transform of the Frostmann measure here. This gives you the mapping which gives the non-removability example. So as I said, the problem is what happens in between. And the difficulty is that the maps here, until this theorem of mine, were not known to be able to achieve the maximum stretching. So in a joint paper with Klopp, this is a third paper, we filled the gap. So basically there are sets of positive and finite measure at the critical dimension, so that they are not removable for Helder k quasi-regular mappings. So the idea is the same as I described here, except that in this map here, you put the map that answers the BMO question. So that's the easy part, that's the candidate. The technical difficulty, and it's quite technical as well, is to prove the Helder exponent. What's the Helder exponent? You expect to be what it is, indeed, but the proof is quite technical and involved, and you'll see why in a picture. Just to, for the sake of completeness, the Lipschitz case was essentially already done, so there was no gap to be filled. So the analytic case, it's a theorem by Wee, which says that a set E is removable for Lipschitz analytic functions precisely when the measure is zero, when the area is zero. And the theorem in the quasi world, the above theorem by Klopp, which is here, also works for alpha equals one. So there's no gap left there. So let me just end with depends on how much time I've got left, which I think it's 3 minutes, no? Or four. Okay. So, and then I can actually give a little bit more. Let me give a brief history of the examples and how they are built. So the basic building blocks of these examples are, of course, Cantor sets, but the way they are built is you start with identity on the blue. In the green, you do the radial stretching, and you are conformal, a dilation, on the red. And then you repeat. So then this depends on two parameters. So let's say the outer parameter is R, the inner parameter is sigma to the k times R. which gets mapped to the outer one tips being R, the inner one sigma times K. So this basically, if you repeat in a Cantor type fashion, will give you a K quasi-conformal mapping. So then the problem is how do you choose the parameters. So Astala, what Astala did in his paper to prove the sharpness of the dimension distortion was that he built, well, the unit disk, then let's say three children, for each of the children, three further children, and so on. So if each generation has a fixed number of children, then you start from D, from dimension D, you want to get dimension D prime, you only get D prime minus a certain epsilon, which depends on M. But as M increases, you get closer and closer to D prime. So you glue countably many of those, and then that's how he got his example. What we did in order to get a sharp example of non-removability for L infinity in the in dimension 2 over k plus 1, which I mentioned before, is basically we start with one disk, then three children, then 100 children, and so on. So the number of children increases very much with the generation, and then you get that D goes to D prime, but still you get measure 0 here. What basically happens is you start with a gauge function here of the type T to the D times epsilon of T. I will explain what this is. And then you get to, well, T of D prime as a gauge function, no? Meaning positive and finite here, but then it's positive and finite for this gauge function, which is slightly, I mean, corresponds to slightly larger dimension here. No? Or if you start from here, you will get to something smaller here. This epsilon of T is related to the product of the proportion of areas. So what this means is the following. Assume you're filling your disk with children of the same radius, which is the usual way to do it. Then, no matter how you do it, no matter how small this radius is, you can always fit a smaller radius here, I mean smaller disk here, of the radius comparable to the neighboring ones, so that the proportion of areas of the children, I mean the area of the union of the children divided by the area of the father here, is always going to be less than 1 minus epsilon for a certain absolute constant epsilon, so this product will tend to zero. So in order to make things work, and this is the technical difficulty in the examples I explained before, you need the product of the proportion of areas to be close, I mean to converge, and in order to do that, things get nasty. So basically you need to fill the whole disk. And then this is basically the picture, what you get. Something like this. So, I mean, it's a Cantor type set. You need to fill the whole disk. And then the problem is how you compute the Hausdorff measures here and here. And it's extremely technical. So thank you. Thank you very much.